Hello, welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and we're broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on the University of British Columbia campus. And happy Halloween to you. In honor of Halloween, I dug up from the depths of the Synchronicity archives an episode way, way back from January 2010. This is Paul Elder talking about remote viewing, psychic government spies, and near-death experiences. So I hope that you enjoy it, and I hope you have a wonderful, safe, and very happy Halloween. Good morning. Welcome to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie. Thank you so much for being with me today. On the show, we have a very special guest. We have Paul Elder. He is the author of Eyes of an Angel, and I'm just going to bring him right up on the air so we can jump into this interview. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Marie.
How are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. So I have your book here, Eyes of an Angel, and I just finished reading it last night, and what a wonderful book, first, I must say. Very interesting, and there's a lot of adventures going on. So, Paul, I wanted to ask you, I'm reading your book, and it talks about your experiences with soul travel, your experiences with the Munro Institute, and I'm wondering, I noticed on your bio that you had some involvement with Stargate.
Yes.
And there isn't anything that I saw about that in the book, so can you tell me a little bit about what your involvement with Stargate was?
Oh, okay. It's sort of a rather lengthy story, so I'll sort of back up a little bit. I'm a survivor of three near-death experiences, the drowning when I was 12, and the car accident at 17, and the heart attack when I was 41 in the middle of a hockey game. And each of those experiences was really profound on their own. And essentially, you can't have an experience like that without having your life changed somewhat. About the time of the heart attack and the near-death experience in the ambulance, I began to have out-of-body experiences, hundreds of them over the years now. And I found out about a place called the Munro Institute in Virginia. And this place was developed or set up by a fellow named Robert Munro. And Robert Munro, back in the 50s, when he was a younger man, had begun to have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. And he was concerned about the experiences themselves or what it meant. He was concerned about his health, his mental faculties, but he checked himself out with doctors and with psychiatrists, and they all assured him that he's perfectly well. So he kept a meticulous track of these experiences that he had. He would write down, for instance, even what the pressure, the humidity was outside, the time of day, the direction that his head was pointing, all trying to get a correlation or figure out if there was some common thing that allowed for this to happen, in which he would find himself floating out of his body and flying to literally any place on the planet or in between, into the other world, into the spirit world. And I began to have those kinds of experiences and found out about the Institute, which was sort of a world leader, a pioneer in consciousness research. And I found out that you could attend the Institute. You could actually take, ordinary people could take week-long classes there and learn about their own consciousness. And during that period of time, when I began to attend the Munro Institute, and got to go into the big lab and get hooked up with the machinery and the scan and everything else that measures brain waves and measures relaxation, etc., etc. And some of the things that I was able to experience or told them about got people's attention or some people's attention. And I came upon or was introduced to a fellow. And this is many years ago now, who turns out was the former, or the director, the Pentagon director of this project Stargate, which was a top secret project that the U.S. military had begun and developed at Stanford Research Institute in California, along with the technology of the Monroe Institute in Virginia. And they put these two programs together. And essentially, if you're, I'm not sure, are you familiar with this remote viewing and with Stargate?
I'm a little bit familiar with what remote viewing is. I actually have Jay here from vanmusic.ca, and he does the show before mine, and he has done a little bit more research. Jay, did you want to ask a question?
Well, I didn't really have a question. I was just hoping to listen in because I'm really interested in the topics. But yeah, I'm a little familiar with remote viewing. I myself have had, I've been doing out-of-body experiences and lucid dreaming for about 15 years. I've been published in the Ethnogen Review regarding OBEs with the use of iboga. But yeah, I myself am a little more familiar with that stuff. And one of the first books I read on astral projection when I first started having experiences was Leaving the Body, which I believe was by Robert Monroe.
Monroe's books are Journeys Out of the Body.
Yeah, Journeys Out of the Body.
Okay.
My bad.
So you're fairly familiar with, you know, with the background on it. Thank you. I can't remember where I was.
You were just briefly going to go into the remote viewing aspect, I believe.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. What we discovered is that, what I discovered is back in the early 70s, in response to a threat or perceived threat from the Soviet Union, the CIA had intelligence that the Russians actually had psychics who were trained to spy on America, that they could literally sit in a darkened room in the Soviet Union and draw the elaborate drawings of missile sites in America. So that was a grave concern to them. And so they approached the Stanford Research Institute, as I mentioned, and there were two scientists there, Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, who were the sort of the leading edge, if you will, in research into consciousness itself. And they'd been working with a fellow named Ingo Swann. And Ingo Swann was probably one of the best psychics in America from New York. He was an author and an artist. And they began to work with Ingo Swann, and they were approached by the CIA at about the same time. And their question was, having the speculation or the intelligence that the Russians were able to do this, did they think that this was possible? And the scientists said, yes, very much, that it's possible. And their second question then, of course, is, how do we defend against this? And they pretty much said, good luck. And the third question would be then, is this something we can do? And they believed it was. So with the funding of about $50,000, which was really a fairly good funding in those days, nowadays nothing, for an 8-month study, they developed, along with the help of Ingo Swann and a couple of other people named Pat Price as well, they developed this program, which became phenomenally successful. Known by various names, from Grill Flame to Stargate, in its final name, excuse me, and developed this program that they ran for many, many years, essentially training psychics or military personnel, mostly in this case. They found, strangely enough, that people that had near-death experiences seemed to have an aptitude for this or an extra ability. And being in the military, they had lots of those guys who had those kinds of experiences, so were able to recruit them or go through their files and find people that they thought might be good candidates. Now, what we found since then is that you don't have to have had a near-death experience. Or anything else. There are some phenomenally talented remote viewers out there who have not had any of those experiences. It does seem to matter, though, in the amount of time that people spend inside meditating or just observing their own consciousness in general. At any rate, I was introduced to some of these people and found it absolutely incredible. At that time, I was the mayor, I was a businessman, I'm a former CTV News reporter. from back in Calgary a long time ago, and went on subsequently to, you know, get into politics, and I became the mayor of a small city in Saskatchewan, about 18,000 people, the city of Swift Current, for many years. And all the while this was happening, I was spending time at the Monroe Institute in Virginia and learning about these incredible programs and incredible people. And so subsequently, I was trained with a number of the original Stargate remote viewers, and now essentially I'm, along with Skip Atwater, I'm the principal remote viewing trainer at the Monroe Institute. And I found out, now, and this is an interesting thing, because during the years that that I attended Monroe Institute just as a participant, there was this lab tech guy. He was the voice on the other end of the headphones when I was in the lab, in the isolation chamber, and just a very mild-mannered, very quiet guy named Skip. And after I meet up with Dale Graff, who was the former Pentagon director, and other people in the, you know, I find out that this quiet lab guy named Skip actually used to be known as Captain Fred Atwater, and that he was, in fact, the recruiting officer and the operations manager for Stargate itself.
Wonderful. I think Jay has a question for you.
Yeah, just a quick question. Now, I'm just curious as to what the difference between remote viewing and astral projection is. Like, does a remote viewer, do they have the out-of-body experience, or is it, are they just watching their consciousness and going with the imagery and sensory perceptions that they're seeing while they're still in their body in a meditative state?
Right. Well, it can encompass both things. Doing remote viewing, you can utilize out-of-body states, or sometimes people call it biolocation, in which they're actually there at the site, feeling all of, or, you know, having the impression that they're there at the site and being able to interact with the site. Very, very hard to do. Generally speaking, remote viewing is quite a bit different than out-of-body experience. Remote viewing, a person would be sitting at a table, perhaps, or laying down, and essentially putting their mind or taking their senses to the location. So typically when we do in training, when we teach people how to do this, we have to be able to give them feedback so that it becomes an objective experience. Out-of-body experiences and things of that nature, although they can be profound and life-changing. I mean, you can have an experience with a spirit guide, or you can meet the Christ consciousness. But for the most part, you can't prove it. It's your subjective experience, whereas with remote viewing, you can prove it. We have a piece of paper where you have just drawn a picture of it. You have described a location. And so essentially, I mean, sort of to get down to it, I mean, remote viewing is the ability, and this is an innate human ability, to be able to describe accurately any person, place, or thing, or event, essentially in the universe. We are connected to all information in the universe, all human beings, all of consciousness, for that matter. And it's sort of like, if you ask, and what's unique, I think, about remote viewing and about the program, if you ask a psychic, you can take, you know, some of the best psychics and say, well, that's incredible, teach me how to do that. How do you do that? And they would be able to say, well, I don't know, it's just there. I just know it comes to me. Well, remote viewing was probably sort of the first attempt. It was, I mean, a government-led laboratory attempt at teaching people how to be psychic. And so in that fashion, it had to be repeatable, it had to be double-blind, and all of those sort of requirements, you know, that you would have from a scientific point of view. And so they developed in the lab this process of being psychic. And essentially that's remote viewing. We're typically, just to give you an example here, in the training process, so we can provide feedback to the students, we would have another party entirely put together what we call targets. And now these would be locations or persons, places, or things or events going back in time, anywhere on the planet or in the universe for that matter. And we would have those people put together a pool of targets, perhaps 100 different persons, places, or things, right? And put random numbers, or attach random numbers to these targets. And essentially they would take, say, a photograph, a distinct photograph of some person, place, or thing on the planet, put it in an envelope, seal it up, and assign a target number to it. When it came time, we would have one of the students or somebody pick one of those envelopes out of, say, 100 envelopes. They would pick one of them. And then we would, after the training, we would say, okay, describe the location depicted by the photograph in the envelope at the time it was taken. And essentially what we're doing is we're directing through psychic means our students or our participants to go to the location and focusing only on the number or the location itself and apply all of their senses. What do you hear? What do you smell? What do you see?
Are all dreams astral projections? Because in your book, it talks about how when we're sleeping, we go into this kind of astral dimension. And so I'm just wondering, what's the difference between a regular dream that we have and astral travel?
I would say, I don't think there's really much of a comparison other than that the experiences take place in a state when we are in an altered state when our bodies are sleeping. I think dreams are can be quite a bit different in as much as, I mean, dreams can be just about anything from recall or rehashing of day's events, from wishful thinking, from fears, from all of those things. Every single night, however, when we go to sleep, as you lose consciousness, we drift out of our bodies. And so each and every one of us leaves our bodies every night when we sleep. We just are not generally aware of it. And for the most part, we spend, you know, we spend that time on the other side, perhaps with our soul groups, perhaps with our spirit guides, and perhaps just resting as well. But a fairly distinct difference between the two. People who've had an out-of-body experience will describe it. And you've often heard, even from people who had near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, because people question that. Here's a few statistics for you. At the latest survey, and this is according to IONS, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies, in North America alone, there are over 20 million people who have had a near-death experience. Like, that's a tremendous number of people. And I guess it makes sense because with science and medicine being able to pull people back more and more from the edge all the time, this number becomes exponentially larger. And these people generally, I mean, this is for the near-death experiencers, they are life-changing experiences. And medical science, is of the position that if we can't measure it, then it doesn't exist. And these people will have these experiences, describe it as the most profound life-changing event, and it does change them entirely. Oftentimes, in the aftermath, they become more psychic, they develop certain kinds of abilities, and it becomes just a phenomenal change in life for them. Medical science, however, looks at it and tries to come up with a scientific explanation which has nothing to do with the reality of being a spirit. And essentially, we are spirits first, occupying physical bodies. So if science can't measure it, then it doesn't exist. And so we get typically, and I've had this experience myself with doctors saying, well, yeah, that's sort of, you know, as a result of lack of oxygen to the brain, or your brain understands that your body is in imminent danger, so it creates a scenario for you. It's like wish fulfillment. It puts you into a nice state of mind. Well, if that was the case, then everybody would have a different experience. but they don't. From whether it's a three-year-old in California to an old lady in the Soviet Union, they describe pretty much the same thing, the same process, finding themselves floating out of their body, being able to see their body, watch the people around them interact, move to the other side, and sort of very typically very loving experiences. By and large, from the statistics that we have, it appears that somewhere in the percentage of like 98 or 95% of all near-death experiences are of a very positive nature. There are a few or a smaller percentage that aren't, that people describe it as being very scary kind of experiences. We found in the research that people that had, say, drug-induced overdoses, creating a near-death experience or dying in the process and coming back, but those seem to be more of a hellish kind of experience for them, or not as controlled. So a big difference between the two. But one of the things that people describe typically, and they will describe, you know, elaborate or wonderful experiences, and the skeptics will say, well, how do you know it wasn't just a dream or you know, your imagination? And these people, you've often heard this on television and other documentaries when they talk about this, they describe it as being more real than real. The experience itself is more real than real. And you wonder, well, what is that supposed to mean, more real than real? And probably a good example of that would be, let's suppose that you were born with terrible eyesight all of your life, and then on your 18th birthday, somebody handed you a pair of glasses, and you put them on, and you went, holy smoke, look at this. I can look at all the colors. Look at the definition, the clarity. This is incredible. That is more real than real, because we don't see perfectly with our physical eyes, but we can see perfectly with our spiritual eyes. And so when people talk about that and those, you know, glowing reports and loving reports, they're speaking from a place in their heart. And I think for skeptics or for medical science, that it's sort of condescending for the experts, if you will, in the field, if they are debunkers or skeptics, to sort of dismiss or set aside the views and the experiences of 20 million people who say it was the most profound thing that happened in their life.
Paul, we have a question. Jay wanted to ask you something, so go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, I actually just had a quick question with spirit guides, but I also just wanted to touch on what you're talking about with science. I think it's interesting how, like, I personally believe, just from my own experiences, that that as a human being, you are the science. Like, you are the instrument that science would use to test these things. Of course, you're the only one who can verify it. But just a question about the spirit guides, because I myself have had many experiences, and to the point where when I first started having out-of-body experiences, I actually turned away a spirit guide, and I have not seen them since. And at the time, they were a great teacher, and I just took some poor advice from a, you know, not very good psychic, and it's because I was new to the experiences. I was fresh, and I like you said, I had new eyes, and I was amazed at how real this interdimensional being called a human is, and the experiences they have. And so my question with spirit guides is, how would one really discern who is their true spirit guide, or who may just be, you know, what may just be a dream character or an egoic reflection, or even possibly just another energy or awareness that isn't important to your development that you may have contacted or may have just be sharing the same kind of space with, wherever that space may be? Like, how do you justify, how do you, I guess, tell and confirm who is there for your own spiritual interests? Because I do, from my own personal experience, realize that you can contact many different types of awarenesses.
Yes. I mean, there are lots of, trains of thought. I mean, essentially, what I've found over the years is that there really is no separation. And it sounds like hokey-pokey, new-agey, you know, kind of terminology to say, well, we are all one. But essentially, I find that to be true. And I'll get to your question. You can't have this kind of experience. You can't have an out-of-body experience or a near-death experience without reflecting or examining our concept, your own concepts of who you are and how you relate to everything else in the universe. You can't have this kind of experience without examining your concepts of God. And I think over the years, I mean, I used to, having been raised as a Catholic in a, you know, strict Catholic environment, as a Christian, I mean, I had my notion about, I knew who Jesus Christ was. That was the guy who sort of looked like the dude on the wall in the picture, or in the picture on my mom's kitchen wall. And I knew who God was. I mean, he was the depiction in the Bible of this stern-faced old guy with a big gray beard, and he was going to fry my butt. And so we develop, or we have these kinds of notions, and what we're taught in Christianity and many other faiths is this consummate fear of God, fear of being punished and so on and so forth. And what I've found is that is so wrong. There is absolutely nothing to fear from God. And who, and if we examine this and take a look, well, who is God actually? Is it somebody outside of it? Is it some other large being? I mean, you know, God is not, what I found, it's not a personal God that we can call on to help us win bingo on Sunday morning. In most regards, what I believe and what I've discovered after hundreds of out-of-body experiences and three near-death experiences is that there is no separation, that we are essentially all one, and that as a group consciousness, I believe that we are individuated aspects, we are individuated pieces of the consciousness of God. And collectively, in all of us, all living things, including ET, we are the consciousness that makes up God. So if you take a look at it, I mean, as a simile, if you compare the ocean, if the ocean were the consciousness of God, we are the individual drops of water in the ocean. But each of us contains the DNA and the blueprint for the entire ocean. So essentially, as a collective group, you know, that's my belief, that we are God and that we create this world. We create the environment. We create all of these things around us. There are schools of thought that each of us, I mean, that we talk about our higher selves, etc. Do we have spirit guides, or is it our higher self? Well, from my experience, I found that before we come here, I mean, we're multidimensional beings, and essentially we are spirits. And that is our true nature, energy beings on the other side, before we come back to the earth, return many, many times to the physical world. And before we do that, we make agreements or arrangements with other members or other parts of our consciousness field or other souls to play certain roles in our lives. So we come back with a family of souls, if you will, and we go back and forth, learning and developing. And essentially, I think we are sort of God's attempt at continuing experience. And also, in addition to that, we kind of lay out the kind of lives or the kind of experience that we're going to have. And we make agreements with other people to fill some of those roles, and including spirit guides. So we agree with spirit guides to come along with us to help us experience those things and to make sure that we do experience the things that we want to experience. And oftentimes, it's the tough stuff. It's the tough stuff that we come here for. If we want easy, we can stay on the other side. We come here to be sort of engrossed, and in order for this to work, we can't know who we really are. We have to think we're alone so that we can experience the depths of the depression. We can experience all of these wonderful, juicy emotions from fear and hate and lust, things that we can't other than vicariously experience on the other side. The physical form allows us to sort of descend, if you will, into the grosser vibrations to have these real powerful experiences. How do you know the difference between spirit guides? There could be many, and people often ask in the classes that we teach at the Monroe Institute and at other places, the experiential classes, is, you know, how do I know who my spirit guide is? I want to meet my spirit guide. Sometimes And some people certainly do. Some people will meet their spirit guides on the other side, have out-of-body experiences, etc., meet them in the dream worlds. Oftentimes, they're not forthcoming. And I believe that it has to do with some people. If you knew who your spirit guide was, it might change how you do life. And they will never interfere with that. In fact, it's their job to make sure that you experience the things that you want to experience, including the tough stuff. So we got this notion raised as whatever, you know, the religious denomination that we are, whether Christian or otherwise, we have this notion or thoughts about that we all have guardian angels, and we indeed do, but in the form of spirit guides, I believe. And that the guardian angels are here to make sure that we don't get ourselves into trouble, to keep us from harm. Well, if that's the case, we got a sorry bunch of guardian angels, don't we? Because we all get our butts in trouble. And the reality is that they're here to make sure that we experience the things that we want to experience.
We are speaking with Paul Elder. He's the author of Eyes of an Angel, and he's also a remote viewing teacher at the Monroe Institute. So we had a caller just a few minutes ago looking for a reliable psychic, and I know there was one part in your book where you had an experience with a phenomenal psychic. So I'm just wondering, are there any local psychics in Vancouver or the British Columbia area that you would recommend?
Oh, goodness. I really don't know. I'm sure that there are many good psychics. I choose for myself. I don't visit psychics anymore. Essentially, I don't want to know. I mean, I'm excited about life. I'm excited. I can't wait for tomorrow to come to see what happens. And but so no, I'm not sure. That the psychic that I talked about and wrote about in my book was phenomenal. And her name is Janine. And she operated. She operates out of Calgary, and I think if you can, I think people can Google that. I think if you Google Janine Psychic or Tarot Reader, she was actually a tarot card reader, that you'll be able to pull up her website and get her phone number and check her out. She's very good.
Great. Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. I don't see psychics either, so when people call asking for a recommendation, I'm like, I have no idea.
Yes, I'm essentially the same way. However, I did run into, you know, this, I didn't, you know, this young lady was phenomenal, and she lives in Calgary and still operates from what I understand, and she used to, I think she's changed locations, and but if you Google Janine tarot card reader, you'll pull up her website, and I think there's a phone number there, and you can call her.
Cool, thank you.
I wanted to make just a couple of notes here for those interested in remote viewing and learning about remote viewing. In addition to the classes that I teach at the Monroe Institute in Virginia, I also teach weekend remote viewing classes here in the island and in Vancouver. I've done a number of them in Vancouver. And it's really, really a phenomenal process, and I'm just totally blown away continually by the talent of some of the students or some of the people that come along. I mean, people pretty much right off the streets and doing some incredible remote viewing. Now, this is you have to understand. I mean, this remote viewing probably is about as impossible as it could be from a normal perspective. All right. How do we describe any person, place, or thing or knowledge or event going back in time? The odds against it really are probably billions to one, and people do it all the time. Really, really a phenomenal thing, and I get really excited even with the workshops, knowing that all of the people sitting in the class, you know, 20, 30 people, that at some point over that weekend, they're going to get it. And it's like, holy smoke, I just did the impossible. And it's really sort of a remarkable thing. And I think this is why I so much enjoy teaching remote viewing. I teach other consciousness expansion classes at the Monroe Institute, from the Gateway to their Guidelines and Lifeline programs. But I think remote viewing is so unique because you can prove it to yourself and you can prove it to others that we have access to all information in the universe. Really phenomenal thing.
Wonderful. Well, your website is paul-elder.com, I believe.
Yes, www.paul-elder.com.
And that course will be listed on your website?
Absolutely.
Now, Paul, I wanted to ask you a question about my own personal thing, because I've just been curious about this. A few weeks ago, I had this dream, and I wrote about it on my blog, and some people said that it sounded like astral projection or astral travel. And so I just wanted to run it by you and get some input on how we know if we're having, like, are there any signs. The dream, I was wherever I was hanging out in the dream, and then all of a sudden I felt like my whole body was, like, sucked up. And through this, I don't know, this portal, and then all of a sudden I'm out in space in some other solar system looking around, and all the planets were really close and big. And I'm just wondering, was that astral travel or was that just a really cool dream?
Well, I mean, you know, everybody's experience, you know, is to themselves. So I'm not sure. It does have some of the earmarks of it. I think the thing about astral travel or about out-of-body experiences is the awareness of it, or that you are consciously in control. Now, there is lucid dreaming, which can also be very powerful. And this is the thing, if you can identify the fact that you're dreaming while you're dreaming, you can turn it into a lucid dream, and you can change it into an out-of-body experience, or you can be anywhere and do anything that you want. It sounds like the experience that you have would probably, you know, develop or came out of the dream state and, you know, moved into sort of an out-of-body experience. Typically, people, if you're consciously aware of your environment, dreaming is one thing, but if you dream that you floated out of your bed or that you're floating over top of your bed, right, but you can see yourself in bed, or you can reach down with your hand and touch the bed and feel it, that is an out-of-body experience. Generally speaking, the full vibrational kind of lift-up is very hard to accomplish as an out-of-body experience. It's overwhelmingly powerful and real, more real than real. But there are different degrees of out-of-body experience. And it sounds like that's probably what did happen to you. Were you seemingly aware of your surroundings and aware that you were dreaming or aware that you were there?
No, I wasn't at the time. I'm not quite sure because it happened really quickly. And Jay has a question also.
Okay. Before we get into that, I was just going to say that a lot of times the dreams can be the brain's interpretation of an out-of-body experience. Because your brain, your left brain, will try to put some semblance or some order to it for you. But essentially, sometimes it's inexplicable. And so what we found, I mean, because we go out of body every single night when we fall asleep, but sometimes our dreams will reflect that, and it's the brain's attempt to put sort of some rational basis to it. And it seems like an odd thing because in many cases when you're dreaming, if you're having a powerful sort of lucid dream, while you're dreaming, it seems to make sense. And you wake up and you go, my God, how could that, you know, why would I not know I'm dreaming? Because that was completely ridiculous, right? But while you're dreaming, it makes perfect sense. Yes, Jay?
All right. My question was about the vibrational stage of astral projection, because I have found for myself, like, I guess my question is it always necessary? Because I have found that the more I astral project and the longer that I've been doing it, the less I have the vibrational state. When I first started having the experiences, the vibrations and the sounds just so intense before the actual projection. And now I find I can just slip in and out without having the earthquake-like experience of those vibrations, the complete intensity of the I guess the the pre-projection. Is that normal? Is that something that happens? Is a vibrational state a requirement of the astral projection, or is it something that comes and goes with experience?
I agree with you entirely. And for me, I mean, I experienced pretty much the same things. I began to have spontaneous out-of-body experiences, very powerful, pounding vibrations, increasing to high-pitched vibrations, and then I can move out of my body. But very vibrational, energetic, feeling like every molecule in my body was buzzing. And allowing for that lift out to take place. It's sort of what they call a classical out-of-body experience. Vibrations increasing, floating gently out of your body up to the ceiling. You can turn around. You can see your body back in bed. Very, very powerful. Like, you don't have a perception that you're leaving anything behind other than you can see this your shell, your body left over. But your perception is that you have all your faculties. You have your fingers, your hands, your toes, and everything with you in an energy body form, and you can travel anywhere in the universe. And it's so exciting, the classic out-of-body, but so hard to do. I found that I had to, in the early stages when that happened, that it was so exciting that I had to get out of the room generally as quickly as possible to get away from my body, or the excitement would push me back into the body. But what I found over the years, that is very hard to do. It is so exciting and so powerful and so more real than real. It's so hard to do that now I found over the years the necessity for doing that has waned. And in fact, it becomes much easier now just to will myself to being somewhere else. And I think you've experienced that. Robert Monroe talked about that as well. And in our books, both of our books, we talk about, you know, the classical out-of-body and how exciting and how, you know, powerful the experiences are, but hard to accomplish. And so most people that I know who are adept at out-of-body experiences at will have changed that process. And we find that we don't have to go through that whole vibrational lift-out thing, that eventually you just simply focus your attention where you want to be, and you can go there.
So, Paul, we just have about 7 minutes left in the show, and I wanted to ask you a question. You mentioned the earmarks of a typical astral projection. Can we just run through what some of the major indicators are that you're having an astral experience?
Well, I mean, people can interpret them in different ways. I would think that in order to accomplish this, you mean?
Well, like when I was talking about my being sucked into outer space and whether that was real or not, and you said that there were some of the earmarks there, are there some key indicators that it was... That you're experiencing an astral projection as opposed to just something your brain's making up in dream state?
Right. As I mentioned, sometimes it's like I believe that, you know, dreams are the body's or the brain's attempt at rationalizing an out-of-body experience. So people that have a lot of typical dream experiences, like as children, people may dream of being able to fly. I know when I was a kid that I certainly had a lot of flying dreams, and many people do. And that, in part, I think, is the brain's attempt at rationalizing out-of-body experiences or putting into a perspective. So I think the typical earmarks, if you feel, now, the difference between, and we're talking about classical out-of-body experiences, tremendous, and folks will have awakened with this, there's a couple of background things that I should get to that I want to talk about really quickly about consciousness itself, all right? Different levels of consciousness, beta consciousness or beta levels of consciousness, having to do with the frequency of brain waves. While you're wide awake, your brain waves run between 16 and 32 cycles per second. So fairly quickly. During the daytime, we often drift into alpha states of consciousness and just daydreaming, driving our car, washing dishes, mowing the lawn, in which we're completely somewhere else in our minds, but operating, doing something, usually mechanical things, because we're occupying the left brain, which allows us to move into the right hemisphere. And the level or frequency of our brain waves drops in half from the wide awake state to down to 8 to 16 cycles per second. In the sleep states, the next level of consciousness is theta levels of consciousness, usually associated with rapid eye movement, dream states, and so on and so forth. In theta, our brain waves, the frequency functions between 4 and 8 cycles per second. And then below that is delta sleep consciousness, which is usually unconscious, deep sleep, restoration sleep, between 0.5 cycle and 4 cycles per second. Now, what we find, people have this notion that when we sleep, that our bodies just lay inert and do nothing, which is, and that's far from the truth. When we sleep, our bodies move a lot of energy. So the different muscle groups might tighten up a particular muscle in your body and relax and move on to other muscle groups and so on and so forth. The other thing that happens is when we approach the rapid eye movement and dream state, the theta states of consciousness, our bodies go into sleep paralysis. In other words, we lock right up. We sort of become paralyzed. And that's just a natural defense mechanism that keeps us from hurting ourselves by acting out our dreams or hurting others by acting out our dreams. So our limbs absolutely lock up and we get this sensation. And many, many people have experienced this, of waking up in the morning or whatever, sometime in the night, and still your mind is completely awake, but your body is still locked up. And it's sort of like waking up with this heavy weight on your body, and there's some fearful things that can come out of that, or some fear that comes out of that, out of a totally natural process. So if you experience that, then you'll understand that that's just a natural process. Your body goes into sleep paralysis, and you're in a deep state. I think some of the earmarks for that, I'll describe the vibrational state of consciousness and the vibrational state of lifting of out-of-body experiences. For me, oftentimes, I would be drifting back and forth into that state of sleep. And every night when we go to bed or we go to sleep, we move into that world of out-of-body experiences. We go out of our body. In that place, as you're drifting off into sleep, when in that hypnagogic state comes on, when you begin to get little dream images flooding your mind, little things through the day coming up into your mind, that place between awake and asleep is so powerfully critical. In that space, it's sort of like a fine balance. We're not asleep, we're not awake, we're just sort of drifting. In that space are hundreds of levels of consciousness that we can explore in an out-of-body state, in a conscious state. And so attempting to hold that state or hold ourselves in that place is sort of key to out-of-body experiences. And so if you find, when you're doing that, if you find suddenly that you become aware of vibrations building in your body, a high-pitched sound perhaps in your ears, or the sensation of movement, these are all associated with sort of a classic out-of-body experience. If the vibrations increase and you find yourself floating up to the ceiling, obviously, if you are aware and you can react with your environment, these are, sort of signs or earmarks of out-of-body experiences. If you can control or find yourself in a very powerful state where you know you didn't make this up, there's nothing to do with imagination, and if it comes as a surprise to you, but you are critically aware, then chances are you're out of body.
Well, Paul, it's already time, already 10 o'clock here to wrap up. So I want to thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had another hour to talk more. This is such a fascinating topic.
Yes, it was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to say thanks as well, Paul. Thanks for letting me sit in on this session here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. So again, your website is paul-elder.com?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Paul, for being on the show. So this has been Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. We have been talking with Paul Elder, author of Eyes of an Angel. He's also a remote viewing and astral travel teacher at the Monroe Institute in Virginia. And you can look on his website, paul-elder.com, if you live in the Lower Mainland or on Vancouver Island. He offers courses occasionally and has one coming up soon. So paul-elder.com. Thank you so much for joining me. We'll be back next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific. Have a wonderful weekend. Up next is Scotty's Scenic Drive.
Up next is Parts Unknown with DJ Chris Arific on CITR.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe located in the McMillan building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
Feel our positive energy at Falun Dafa Fellowship. Falun Dafa, also called Falun Gong, is an ancient spiritual discipline based on the principles of truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. It's a self-cultivation practice that improves mental and physical wellness through meditation and simple exercises. It's been well documented to improve mind and body, relieve stress and anxiety, increase energy and vitality, and promote morality and spirituality. Why not give yourself a chance to learn free of charge? To learn more, please visit our website at FalunDafaFellowship.com.